We've talked about centering prayer, which is this basic way of coming into openness and predisposing ourselves to the movement of the Spirit in silence that comes out of the contemplative Christian tradition. Yesterday we talked about a kind of sung prayer or hymns of praise and vows that we believe was a practice of the early church and called singing the jubilations. And there is some references in that we'll ship off about that practice. Both of these practices are opening up kinds of practices. The centering prayer is a predisposition to kind of begin to notice the kind of things that are going inside our heads that are keeping us from being as open as we might be. And the sung prayer is a way of opening our ears and also stopping some of the internal dialogue that often stands between us and God and us and the other. Today we're going to talk about a more direct method. It's kind of a bridge between inner and outer, which is how to come into deeply into relationship with other human beings. And I just ran across this title, Tithing, very recently myself. And it's a title, it was originally recovered apparently by Madeline Lango in one of her books called A Wind in the Door. And tithing may be most simply described as a conscious act of spiritual presence. Mm-hmm. Conscious act of being deeply present to the other. Now, Madeline Engel recovered this word from Scottish dictionary from the last century. And there it says that tithing means, it comes from the same root of kiss, kith and kin, that kind of deep relationship. And it means to show yourself in your own true guise, or to show yourself not in disguise or mask. I might be doing injustice to Merton's work, but it might be say to kind of show your true self rather than your false self. We're interested in this because the community we belong to, Shalom Ministries, has, I think we've been trying to be about this kind of presence with other people in our work and mission, and we call it mission in reverse, which means to abide with other people, to be with people in the deepest way that we can, and to be open to the guidance of the other. And again, this is one of those, I mean, a lot of what we talk about is deceptively simple sounding, I think. It may be simple-minded too, I don't know, but it's deceptively simple sounding. I found it extraordinarily difficult, and still do, to be fully present to the other person, to have each of you be my teacher, to have each person I meet on the street be my teacher, to realize that the person who's homeless, the person who's chronically mentally ill, the person who's intoxicated, the person who smells really bad, that comes into the church and disrupts Sunday morning worship, that person has something to teach me. But to figure out how to be with that person, and this doesn't mean being kind of led any place by folks either, but it means to see within that person the core of the true self, maybe, of that person. And the Savory and Byrne talk about they have a hierarchy of connectedness from the physical down to the psychological and then the spiritual. And they talk about a spiritual kind of relationship being more in communion with one another rather than as a much deeper level, a level of knowing at a very deep level, rather than say an empathic knowing that one might see in a therapeutic relationship. I think that Nancy and I would both say that therapeutic relationship, both of us having done therapy, really moves back and forth. I mean, I think there are times when we're in a healing relationship where I think we move into this real sense of communion with the other. But I think the notion here about tithing and then about mission reverse, is to really treat one another as we would like to be treated ourselves. I mean, it really is a movement into relationship that is much more mutual and much more open than we are often able to be about. And it's a very difficult kind of process, because part of this process is to be in that kind of deep relationship with the true self, I think. Because we can really be led around by our false self or other people's false selves. And so, again, I think of Wink's work, where he looks at Jesus, what he calls Jesus' third way of transformation. So it's not being a doormat. So when the people on the street con me, it's not being conned by them, because if I'm conned by them, I'm not going to be transformative. I'm going to be a mark. You know, mark is right. I mean, that's true. And they're going to realize this guy with the collar. I mean, he's a do-gooder, right? He's a do-gooder, which means he's an object to be manipulated. It also doesn't mean that I'm just going to turn people off. It means I am going to go the second and third mile with them. So I'm not going to be aggressive to them, but I'm going to hang in there. It's very difficult to do that, because I don't know about you and the places you are, but the places I am, I'm hit on, because I wear a clerical collar, I'm hit on constantly on the street. And so it would be real easy for me to adapt a certain kind of stance to protect myself, to close myself, so that it would just make it easier. But each time I run into somebody, I don't know what's going to happen. Each time, it's a process of opening up, you know. And with some folks, it's the same person, you know, the 10th encounter with the same person. The kiting method that these folks talk about is basically a very simple kind of method, and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about this, but it's coming into our center. It's again coming into silence and acknowledging Christ's presence with us, and acknowledging our willingness to be moved by the Spirit, acknowledging our willingness not to have a lot of preconceived agendas we're going to run into this contact with the other around, and then to focus on that person, to kind of move the focus from ourselves to the other person, and then to begin our connection together, begin our transaction, use that kind of language, begin our conversation, begin our being together. I'd like to just give you a few examples of some surprising ways that this has happened with us, and then I'd like us to do an exercise to have us kind of share similar kind of experiences. I think this is something that's common to many of us in many ways, and I think we can have a lot of richness if we can kind of come out of your experience as well as our own. One situation, which was written in some books on mission reverse, happened in Africa, where some community development people had a certain amount of money that they had available for a particular area, and this was an area that was very, very underserved. There was a lot of alcohol abuse. There were many health problems. There was not a good educational system, and so they sat down with folks, and they were committed to being with folks and hearing what the local people wanted. And so they had this big meeting. They're kind of brainstorming together, trying to figure out what they were going to do together. And the local people decide, almost to a person, they wanted to build a soccer field. Okay. So here are these eight folks who are kind of looking at, you know, the fact that people need health care, there was a substantial substance abuse going on, education problem. And so their initial response was, you know, I mean, how can you want a soccer field when all these other things are such life, you know, threatening, such life-giving kind of things? But they sat on their impulse and they went with it. And it turns out what happened was they started to play soccer, and the people started going to soccer games rather than drinking, and then people started developing some other kind of resources themselves, and on and on. And so it turned out to be a success story, because the folks they hung out with, in fact, were tapping into some real needs in that community. Now, you know, this doesn't always work, folks. I mean, and I think that's part of some issues of discernment we can talk about as we go along. But an example that comes, a couple examples that come out of our ministry in Chicago is, as many of you know, I work primarily with people on the streets, but also now in SROs. You have lots of SROs in Seattle, I understand.
Fewer and fewer.
Huh?
Fewer and fewer.
Yeah, that's most places, that's right. SRO, you know, single room occupancy hotels, right? A lot of places pretty good seasonal work. People come down the Skid Row. The original Skid Roads was Skid Row was in Seattle. And that's where you skidded the logs out, and then you came and you hung out until you were able to work again. And anyway, there are places where people who've got very limited incomes can live in tiny rooms. And it either means single room occupancy or single resident occupancy. Only a person can be in a room. Usually the bathrooms down the hall are shared, or, you know, and usually there are no cooking facilities. But at any rate, and the ones in Chicago, most of them are really in pretty bad shape. So, you know, they got lots of critters running around, and the ceilings are falling and stuff like that. So
critters not being ground squirrels and chipmunks.
That's right. Yeah. And so I was originally asked to go into this hotel and to do Bible study by a social worker. And I said, I won't go in and do Bible study, but I'll go in and hang out with people and see what they want me to do. And sure enough, I hung out for a little while. I said, let's do Bible study. I said, fantastic. After a while later, they said, would you bring the Eucharist? Well, I'm a UCC manager. I said, well, we call it communion. But yeah, I'd be happy to. This is an Episcopalian woman. Well, at that point, I'd just been licensed. Now, in our denomination, you can be licensed, which means, you know, you can do the sacraments, but only take in one parish. I was still in seminary, but I was able to offer the sacraments, and so I had this dilemma about, you know, what would be appropriate in this place. And so, I mean, I was new to ministry, and so I didn't have a communion center or anything, and so I started looking around for an inexpensive communion center. Well, as it turns out, some friends of ours who were in a program, a Catholic program, had a very fancy gold chalice. And they didn't find it appropriate for the group that they were working. The group liked them very simply. So they had this, well, we'll let you use this gold chalice if you'd like. Very ecumenical. I mean, it was really wonderful to get this Catholic chalice and patent. Mm-hmm. But it was very fancy. This is the guy that you'd see in a very fancy church. And so my initial response was, I thought, you know, here this thing is, and here's this little tiny room with the stuff coming down the ceiling, and really not. And maybe an earthenware thing would be better. So I started looking at earthenware things. But then I kind of sat on an impulse, and I went out and I talked to people. I said, we're going to have communion soon. Some friends of ours have offered this very, you know, pretty chalice. What would you like? So I actually asked folks, you know, what they and they said it would be wonderful to have a beautiful chalice to symbolize the sacred here. I mean, to symbolize our faith coming to the table here in this place of physical awfulness. So that's one example, I think, of just kind of changing my impulse to ask the other person about what fits for them. Another situation we ran into was that the Presbyterian Church has a wonderful program, by the way, called Self-Development of People. Do any of you know about that program? It's a wonderful program. It's a program that's designed where poor people request a grant, poor people administrate the grant, and the people who receive the service are the same people who've requested and administrate it. I mean, it really is a grassroots program. We had this friendship club going for a while, and we were struggling because we didn't have any much funding. And we went to the Presbyterians and we asked for a grant. And one of the things that people really wanted to do is they wanted to get jackets that said Northmere, that's the name of the hotel, Northmere SRO International Friendship Club, because there were people from different countries living there. A little grandiose, you know, they want to get jackets for the board members and T-shirts for, you know, as many people as we could afford. And I kind of, you know, and that was, you know, this part, again, there's this part of me that's saying, you know, here you are. I mean, you name the need, it's there. And, you know, but I sat on that. And luckily the Presbyterians did too, who came out in business. They said, you know, that's okay. So we went with that wisdom. But then the problem comes, how do you select the colors? You know, you ever see the film Colors? You know, does that ring any bells? The movie Colors? Mm-hmm. You know what that refers to? Mm-hmm. The gang colors. Mm-hmm. So we had to be careful because the t-shirts we chose, why did it get some people wasted? Because there are about 13 gangs operating within about 5 blocks of this hotel. And also we had to worry about, not only about the colors, but also about, it is something that I didn't even imagine, I mean, I kind of vaguely heard about colors. We also had to have block letters, because a lot of scripted letters, a lot of the gangs use as part of their secret signs. So anyway, there's a long process of their educating me about whose colors were whose. And so I think we ended up with Kelly Green and yellow. So yeah, now we might have run into trouble with the Daley administration, but we were pretty safe. I don't think any Irish gang or whatever. But that was a kind of being with those folks in a planning process that I might have a clue. And I learned a lot from them about, now when I see folks on the street kind of, you know, flashing certain kind of colors, I mean, I kind of have a sense of kind of who's doing what. But the point is that it requires me to open that space to have them pace what they want me to do. So it's a matter of creating, of abiding with people and not trying to push my agendas. Now, does that make sense? I mean, do you understand the
Tea House of the August Moon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The orders from on top, and instead Marlon Brando convinces the guys in the charge of the village that what the village needs is a tea house. So they take all the aid stuff for a school and build a tea house instead, listening to the people of the community. And in the movie, it works out fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's the same thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right. It's contextualization. That's the $10 seminary words. Contextualization of a lot of what we do. To that particular place. Again, going to core issues and not getting lost. And tomorrow we're going to talk about kind of the community we belong with, about how that community helps me not get lost sometimes, because it is, you can kind of contextualize the place where you've kind of lost the tradition. And that's one of the dangers and one of the reasons why I think it's so important to look over our shoulder at tradition and at scripture, so we've got those anchor points in our lives. But the world of the other is a unique experience. I think, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about this today, Nancy, one of the things that a lot of folks have really felt alienated about is how completely different we are from one another. I mean, how we can never get inside one another's skins fully. I mean, each of us is such a separate being. And people who, like, I think about Kubler-Ross, for instance, he talks about that kind of sense when someone's going through the process of coming to grips with their own dying, I know how there's that sense of almost absolute separation from. And so a lot of people really feel alienated in that way. And I think there's another way of kind of turning that around and looking at the gifts that each of us has that are so incredibly unique. Each of us is a unique creation. And so this process of opening to one another and kind of coming through some of those barriers is a way of connecting with unique gifts that are truly profound that we can't grasp until we really are with one another. I call it hanging out with folks. And in that way, the pacing of the other, because they're power. I mean, I'm very concerned about power relationships, and so we have these kind of, so people have expectations. And we talked about this some too earlier, where people have expectations, right? I mean, we're talking about, you know, it's like the poor have expectations of me fixing things for them. The people at the community dinners have, they expect that everything's going to be provided for them. Because that's the way the soup kitchens so often have operated in the past. And that's not the way this, that's not the way these dinners operate. We don't get the thing, it's kind of like here, you know, we don't have enough waitry. We never have enough waitry. And so folks in the community need to be a part of that. But there are expectations. And so what we need to do is go beyond those kind of the surface places and figure out how we can share. And what's been helpful, for instance, is some of the folks who are really experts at the soup kitchens have helped us find resources. They say, well, you know, so-and-so gets all their bread from over this place. They only have too much. Maybe you can go get some bread there. So they're helping us find sources. So, again, it's an example, I think, of the kind of gifts that people bring to us. But I think that's the general theme that I'd like us to consider. And what I'd like to do now, unless you have something you'd like to add at this point, Nancy.
I think you're doing fine.
Okay.
Any other opinions? No, actually, I guess there is one thing that I could add, and that is that one way to think about this whole process is that often when you go into a helping situation, we are putting the person that we're helping in a one-down position. And we're really being disrespectful. And I think that's partly why we're apt to be surprised when we get something back. It's like, oh, I didn't know you had any humanity to give, you know? I thought it was all on my side. But I think part of this business of really being in relationship with another person is a profound respect for the other person's humanity, which you've said, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of our friend Claude Marie, the founders of our community. I've not told the story to some of you, but she was in Lesotho as a missionary, and she was very... This is before Presbyterians ordained women, and so she was a missionary because she couldn't be ordained. And she was in Lesotho, and she was there for 2 years. And after a while, because she didn't have any children, people felt sorry for her, so they gave her a child to raise. I mean, they were so kindly to her. I mean, you know, and after she was there for two, but I mean, she was the woman who was, you know, who was really suffering because she didn't have children, and she was there for 2 years, and again, a highly trained nurse, you know, was ready to kind of go in and nurse there, and people were kind of nursing her in this way. And finally, after 2 years, people, you know, she was kind of leaned on by her, you know, her, you know, folks from home saying, now, what are you going to do something here? And she just kind of said, hey, I'm with these folks and wait to have the Spirit lead us. And after 2 years, they came to her and they said to her, we'd like you to do something. And she said, well, what is that? And they said, we'd like you to start a Girl Scout troop. Which was not exactly, you know, what she thought they were going to ask her to do. Maybe build a hospital, or you know, or you weren't going to. But she helped get a Girl Scout troop going, and that movement has spread throughout the homelands and now in much of South Africa. It has been a mobilizing force for Native people in South Africa. So it was it took 2 years. It was the kind of the softness of this way of being, you know, it requires us to be in a very different, very different mode of being with one another. Well, I think what I'd like to do is to suggest that perhaps that we do an exercise together to help bring your experience further, you know, into our conversation. And to have a few moments of silence. So let's do that now, and then I'd like to offer some ideas for you to consider, and then perhaps that'll help enrich our conversation. So let's come into silence. You may recall a time when you had a surprising experience of being taught by an unexpected teacher. It could be a formal teacher, family member, religious figure, a friend or stranger. Could be a person that you met physically, or it could be a person that you met through reading. But just spend a little time recalling one such experience. And allow yourself to recall this experience as you would find helpful. Just spend a minute or two recalling such an experience. Now, if you are still remembering the situation, complete this remembrance and come back to us further so we can reflect on these experiences. Just take a little time.
Shifted my relationship with her, and it also shifted my awareness of what she was talking about, and I started to see it everywhere. So it changed me. And we have a really good relationship now. Her father and I got divorced and everything, and it's kind of a really rough divorce. But I think our relationship, my relationship with this, my stepdaughter, started at that moment. My adult relationship with her. She's now in her 30s. But we have a mature relationship now that goes on beyond the fact that she's my stepdaughter.
Thank you.
I worked in a church in the late 70s when the Southeast Asians were coming in from Minnesota, and so we had a large influx of Southeast Asians, and I lived in a community where they were living. And so the church wanted to do something to minister to these people, to try to bring them in. And someone in the congregation found an ad in which they could order Bibles in Laotian and Hmong. And so the Christian Ed Committee, they thought this was a good idea. They would give these people Bibles. So they bought all these Bibles and they came in. And I realized when I opened the box, I couldn't. There was one word of English. There was no way to orient yourself in the book, so I didn't know which way the language went. And I showed it to the pastor, and he kind of chuckled and said, well, we'll get some people to translate this for us. We'll know who to give the books to, if they're Laotian or Hmong. And we discovered that the people that had kind of started coming to the church for other services could not read their language. And this was before it was public knowledge that it's a spoken language, not a written language. So we had a church with about 200 Bibles in that language. The minister had the presence of mind to say, let's stop trying to do outreach, let's wait till they know what they need. Now they have a very good mixture in the congregation. The Southeast Asians are coming, but it's taken them a while to learn that church is something, religion is something that can be part of their lifestyle. They had other social services that drew them into the church before they started coming to Sunday services or becoming involved in the church service. So it was one of those, we have to wait for them to catch up to what we can offer.
In a way, too, what you're part of your understanding is learning to kind of slow down until they're right. In a place to kind of connect it with the kind of things that you're already about. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a real.
I spent a year teaching English in Africa, in Tanzania. And I had only been there 2 weeks, and I really didn't know the language or know too many people there. And one of the boys at the school was killed. He was hit by a truck, and they had a service at the chapel for the young man. And the whole service was in Swahili. I couldn't understand a word that they were saying or singing. And I just felt you don't need to know words. You can understand the feelings, and everybody cries the same tears. It was a very moving experience for me. Especially only having been there a short time, to just feel that I really was part of all of this.
With such difference being still welcome in. Other experiences of like to share of an unexpected teacher and new understandings. There's some kind of shock here that like that's part of this, huh? It's kind of difference. That's part of these experiences that we're relating, or unexpectedness of, I mean, that was partially what we look at, but it's characteristic embedded in your experience of things that you couldn't have possibly expected or understood being kind of coming out of a situation. I mean, you couldn't have anticipated necessarily this is going to happen. And so it's a way of kind of jarring our perceptions and opening them up. Did any of you have a feeling of at first when these things happened that there was that you wanted to kind of restabilize things? I mean, did any of you have a feeling of like this is such a different person now? I mean, is it kind of reestablish the old relationship, or was there any kind of movement in your any kind of emotional kind of engagement that happened with you, or was it just a smooth transition for you?
I always think when something kind of shocking happens, you have to get away and do something with it inside of yourself. Mm. And if you don't do that, you'll never get it. Mm. Like the event just doesn't happen then, it happens over a period of time inside of you after it actually happens physically.
Like you have to work on it and consolidate and integrate.
Every time I've learned something, it kind of takes my breath away momentarily. There's a certain type of, funny type of pain that's involved in it. Sometimes it's really pain, sometimes it's a little lesser, but there's always some type of pain, I think. A shock to your system. Letting something go.
In some ways, it's a little bit of the death of the self. I mean, it's a death of our own agendas.
Yeah, like something else you have to consider.
Yeah. One of the real struggles we had in Chicago was, as I was on an advisory board for a pastoral counseling program at a treatment center for survivors of torture, and one of the struggles that we had and still have there is that we had trouble finding words for what we're doing. Because the people who were organizing this program were kind of pastoral counselors or ministers. And we started saying, well, wait a second, there are lots of Buddhists here. So should we have monkish counselors? Yeah, because they don't have pastors, and this isn't a church program, so we need to figure out how to address the religious needs, spiritual needs of folks who are non-Christians in a non-sectarian way. And then there are people who don't have, and then the next step was to figure out that the Western European mode for being of help and of assistance to somebody is this kind of one-to-one kind of connection. But for a lot of cultures, that's not the way to do it. In other words, if someone's ill or is you have a ceremony, okay, at the temple, or you have some other kind of, and so what seemed like a pretty easy kind of thing to do, that is to provide kind of counseling, spiritual direction and counseling, really only fit for a limited number of people. And we didn't even anticipate that. And there's a lot of pain. Because there are already a whole bunch of pastoral counselors lined up wanting to do this. Okay? They're all ready.
Ready to do something they knew how to do.
How to do it, that's right. But that wasn't what, what would be of service with these people. And so we had to back way off. And so what we ended up doing then was just on and on, and these things continue. It's like one of the problems is a lot of cultures, I mean, you might find this hard to believe, but a lot of cultures don't like meetings, right? I mean, they don't like them, they don't go to them.
Which one?
But most of us will at least tolerate meetings, but a lot of us will just not come to them, period. So, again, I'm involved with a lot of interreligious dialogue, and so there are folks who would dearly love Native American people to be part of a planning process. Like around the quincentennial, they like Native people. Well, I can tell you, you're going to find very few folks who are going to come into a planning meeting on the traditional Native Americans for planning meetings on the quincentennial. I mean, that just is not their mode. So you need to figure out some way of involving folks. So you have your meeting, you delegate somebody to go out and hang out with somebody, and they may then begin to... So I guess what I'm trying to suggest here is, again, it's just kind of moving out of our own... out of our own preconceptions, to really be with people so that we can really share quite valid and authentic and deep uniqueness of each of us as human beings. And that, to me, is one of the really critical paths of service in our tradition. And I wonder, some of you are more theologically, inclined, can put better vision, but I wonder if that's part of what, this kind of thing is part of what's meant by agape relationship. A really deep, abiding with kind of relationship. I mean, I'm not saying it is, but I'm more trying to get a sense. Maybe someone could reflect on that. To really be with the other in very compassionate and caring kind of ways, which means ways that I'm not going to push my agenda at almost any level. And to have a kind of mutuality. Scott Peck talks about something like this on his stuff on community, where we move beyond trying to convert one another, into a real sense of communion and community. Yes.
The problem I see with all that is the arrogance of thinking that religion is something which is an aim for a large collection of specific practices. You know, that there is, are Buddhist religious in a way that a Christian can say they're religious? Is there something that we both have that is bigger than both of us? I find that very hard to believe.
You find that hard to believe?
Yeah, to say that they're religious.
The Buddhists are religious.
Or for them to say that I'm religious. Mm. You know, assumes that somehow there's some sort of super religion, which if he and I were really smart enough, we could discard these impedimenta and go on to that. You know, that, and it's that's not how religions work usually. I mean, that it's not possible to surpass Christianity or Buddhism or Hinduism, because when you do this, you usually wind up simply with a third religion.
But I don't see why this one leads in that direction. I mean, I'm not following your logic, I guess. But
well, I think to think that there's something superior to pastoral counseling, you know, monkish counseling or being with someone, you know, it still assumes that you want things to go on your own terms. I had a discussion once about this. Someone said that if you're having a meeting of people of different religions, you should have a non-denominational prayer. And I said, sure. And then also, you should also have a non-national anthem. Mm-hmm. I pray to whatever country we might happen to be in and any other country that's opposing it. And you don't, there aren't any national anthems.
But let me stop you there, because I don't think it has to be that way. In my experience of interfaith dialogue is that it's not that way.
But then the question is, why not?
Well, because of the fact...
You have a thought over
there. I'm sorry, yes.
Well, I think we're excluding this, the commonality that we have a great deal. For instance, in our community, we have what we call a Five Cities Christian Women. And we are the food program for the hungry. Well, that excludes Jewish people. And it's just in our name. Mm-hmm. And yet Jewish people are generous, and so are Buddhists. Mm-hmm. They outdo us in many cases. Mm-hmm. We've got to open ourselves to this.
Right. Well, and again, in my experience of being with Buddhists and Hindus, and Catholic Christians and Jews in these kind of settings is not that we homogenize things. That does not happen.
No.
It does not happen. What happens is we're invited in to abide with people who are engaged in their tradition. And so, for instance, we were at a group of contemplative activists at a Hindu monastery, and a Benedictine father offered the Eucharist for the Christians who came to the table. And so we came to the table and had this wonderful Benedictine Mass that the Hindu folks abided with us by sitting around, not participating at the table, of course, but sitting around and seeing us do that and be a part of it. And we sat and watched them engage in their puja. And it wasn't a Christianized puja. It was what they do. And so when we talk about this counseling, it's saying, and again, I mean, we'll come down in very different places and think about what it means to do Christian witness and what it means to do evangelization. I mean, there's a lot of variation in this room, I suspect, of what we mean about what is to be faithful and do that. But what I can say is that in this setting with this center, it was important for us, I mean, to uncover our presuppositions, is what I'm saying. And so, and my assumption isn't that there's some super religion out there, but my assumption is that if I'm going to be of service with somebody else who says I'm in the Buddhist path, where I come down with that, I'm going to help them to deal with their brokenness given who they are and what they're about. And if they think that I'm a worthwhile human being for having helped them do that, they may want to find out more about what I believe. And that's the way I do my witness, okay? Now, other people would say, I want to have a stronger kind of witness there. And I respect that. I won't do it,
no,
but I respect
that,
okay? And so that's all I'm saying. So I'm not trying to put down pastoral counseling. What I'm trying to say is that would be just like somebody coming into this big pastoral counseling center we work with and say, what you really should be doing here is having incense and some ceremonies for folks. And let's not have this dyadic stuff or spiritual direction going on here. Okay, so I mean, so that's as culturally inappropriate or as culturally non-sensitive. I hope that helps.
It just, you know, a lot depends exactly on what you're doing. Yeah, you know, I think, but there's a strong impulse sometimes to try to broaden things out until nothing happens.
I agree.
Actually, I was going to take it in a little different direction. You might want to stay with it.
Okay, let me say one more piece in this regard. My sense is the more I engage, I mean, one of the blessings about dealing with very different kind of situations, like one of the blessings I have working with people who are very different than me, who are very poor, or dealing with very culturally different people, is I can see more easily my own presuppositions. That's one of the gifts I have. In other words, yeah. You hide these things by having these big differences. And so I kind of get the idea easier. There's a lot less difference amongst some of us than if we included this larger community here. So I find it helps me go deeper. From my contact with Buddhists and with Hindus, I am convinced that the Christian contemplative path is more different from those paths than I would have 5 years ago. I'm convinced of that more now than I was 5 years ago. Partially because of the fact that we've been in conversation, because my head was telling me something different. But being in conversation, having experiences with these folks, and sharing those experiences, talking with other Christian contemplatives, and then talking with these other folks, and being with them, has led me to a deeper understanding of my own tradition, I think. Now, let me just say one other piece, and then we'll go through it. I think the other piece of it is that part of what we're about is we're not in isolation. So Nancy and I are related to at least three communities. Seminary community, our home church community, United Church of Christ, and also our ecumenic religious community. And so part
once
of our...
Once in a while I relate to my job, too.
And your job. Yeah, too bad for you.
Not more than 50 or 60 hours a week.
So part of that is our friends, are nudging us and saying, you're off the wall again, George. I mean, this, and so that's helpful. Well, anyway.
I just was making lots of connections here. I think what I want to do is to share a little bit about all the problems you're causing with all of this, in the sense of, it raises some, I hope, creative contradictions for me in terms of, I'm a pastor. I don't relate to as many marginal people as you two do. I only call those some, and I make some connections with the people we like to stop panhandling on the sidewalk in front of our church. But the contradiction is more in terms of, there, I believe in strong leadership, and there are times when I feel like it really works as a pastor in a parish for me to say, here's where we're going. And instead of doing, a lot of listening, in which, things can kind of get fuzzy. And on the other hand, I also, I'm aware of the times when that strong leadership lapses over, and it's a delicate balance, lapses over into controlling stuff, and I get real attached to where I say we're going, and there's not room for that in there. It's just an interesting paradox of I think parishes need strong leadership, and I don't think tithing is inconsistent with that. That's not the point, but it just, it sort of amplifies the difficulty somehow that of discernment, really, yeah. Of when your strong leadership is controlling and when it's not.
One of the examples of that is when a congregation decides to call a pastor. What do they want? They want a strong leader who will listen to us and do what we tell them. And that's not a contradiction.
Well, I understand.
It's not a contradiction. They want a strong leader who will listen, and you got to be both. And I think that's where the presence idea. If you have a very strong idea of the central presence of your congregation, they will trust you to go ahead. Because they don't like just dithering all the time either. But if you don't have that presence, then you have a strong leader in a congregation near us. And first four Sundays, this is the way we will do baptism from now on. This is the, you know, he told them exactly what. They loved him for 6 years. In the seventh year, they threw him out. They just changed their mind, you know, that he was just too strong for them. But for many congregations, and they thought they were one of them, that's what they wanted to do.
Well, and I think there's another, let me throw out another idea. And I'm not sure. The other idea is to kind of is to have, I like this idea of meta, is to, you know, is not to have a specific agenda, but to have a meta agenda. Okay, I have a meta agenda. I mean, believe me. I mean, I have a vision, and it's a pretty strong one. I mean, it's like our church is not a social service agency. Okay, it's not a whole bunch of things. It's a church, and so when people want to turn us into something, it doesn't happen. And what I also know is that what I'm about is encouraging the development of small Christian communities of faith in very broken places. And so if people want me to turn in, if I want our work to turn into a social club or, again, a bunch of other, it ain't going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned. I've got a kind of an overall vision. But how that unfolds, okay?
Yeah.
How that unfolds is going to be a product of our being together, okay? Mm. See, so it's not it's so it's kind of like I'm trying to think of a non-pejorative way of doing talking about this, but it's like I'll give you a good example. One of my heroes in psychology is a guy named Milton Erickson, wonderful hypnotist, a new version, and when he was a kid, this one cow refused to go back to the barn. He was a good Wisconsin farmer's kid. Cow refused to go into the barn, and no matter what they did, the cows wouldn't go in the barn. And so he went out and stood behind the cow and held the cow's tail. And the cow pulled right into the barn. Okay? Okay? So.
Explain that. I don't understand.
Well.
The initial attempts to get the cow into the barn had to do with pushing the cow from behind.
That's right.
Or pulling the cow from in front.
So.
In the direction.
The
farmer wanted the cow to go. So the cow's headed toward the barn, you pull the tail, pulling him away from the barn, he wants to get away from you, he goes into the barn.
Oh,
or
okay.
She.
Yeah. Now I understand, yeah.
So a lot of what I do is being pulled, you know, in the direction that I hope, I pray that we're going to go.
But sometimes also, I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, this example came out well. The soccer field came out well. People ended up eventually building a clinic and having more solidarity and community feeling and all this stuff. Another thing I think you have to be aware of, and it's one of the more difficult parts of discernment in this area, is that occasionally you will find out that even your meta agenda is not a helpful agenda.
That's right.
And there's some very concrete, specific examples in the field of aid, economic aid to developing countries, where the meta agenda has turned out to be very damaging. Well, there's also a concrete example right here in terms of how we have related to the Native American community. And part of our initial motivation for relating to the Native American community was to bring them the true religion, right? Well, in fact, we took away all religion. We left them without a God, without a connection to the sacred at all. And it was soul-destroying to a lot of Native Americans. So I do think that you have to be part of what you have to be open to is the possibility that your whole plan, however well-intended, is wrong for this situation.
Theodore White said the unintended consequences of political action are almost inevitably more serious than the intended one.
That's right.
That you plan something very carefully to get something done, and the things that occur as a consequence of this can be disastrous or very good, but they are not what you thought would happen.
Yeah.
Mm. It's makes politics very, very difficult. Somebody was complaining recently about big companies getting around the regulators. Well, the reason we have regulators is because the big companies were getting around the law courts. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to have another system, and I mean, that doesn't work either.
Well, thank you for being with us. Our time is up. And, tomorrow, we're going to attempt to further move out and talk about and share with you and explore from your perspective, too, the ways that internal work of prayer plays itself out, spills over into our ministries, and how it can be helpful to go more deeply in the work that we're about. So, thanks again.
Thank you.